This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, more of our conversation with Lier Keith, music from Filthy Politicians and Count Zero. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwasti, Wiskaigan. I'm your host, Seymour Life. It has been a very sad time for those in the activist community, waking up to the news that Howard Zinn has died. On the website, there's a tribute to him done by Democracy Now! Also, to all Albertans and Canadians, I want to bring to your attention the Alberta government is trying to steal your rights to water. Click on Is the Alberta Government Water Law Going to Leave You High and Dry link on the Rage website to find out more. The war for water has now begun in full swing. Why is this important to Canadians? Because this is about the tar sands, about the rights of the living world, which you are a part, over those of corporations, about who defines your value and the right to live as a being on this earth. It's about everyday access to water and who decides who survives, because water is life. If this happens in Alberta, it will soon be nationwide. All the more reason to start building and solidifying your cultures of resistance. Lier's discussion on resistance could not be more timely or important. And here is our conversation as it continues.
In the vegetarian myth also, one of the themes to me was you're talking about maturity and talking about immaturity and how we approach the world and maturity and how we approach our activism and things like that.
There's this concept of adult knowledge that a lot of Indigenous cultures have, and the knowledge that we need is the knowledge that we are connected to every living thing and that we are dependent, that we are enmeshed in this web of relationships. And we need to be humble before that. And until we understand that, we're just selfish children. That there's nothing wrong with being an infant, but an infant is really just about need. I mean, you can't provide for yourself, and you need people to provide it for you. We're not infants anymore. I mean, once you can walk and talk and participate, you need to understand that you are dependent and that, you know, humility is the correct attitude to have toward this wondrous and magical planet, you know, embedded in a cosmos that's ultimately made of love. And when you come to your adult life like that, then you make totally different decisions. When you realize that you are not entitled, that you are a responsible member of your community, and that you need to take care of your family, you know, your human community that's around you, and then beyond that, you know, the wider land base that provides life for all of us. I mean, plants are giving us oxygen. Rivers are giving us water. Fish are creating all of the riparian systems that are, you know, so necessary for the continuation of the rivers. And yeah. So there's all these cycles, and life and death is a part of that, that for anything to live, something else has to die. And that is knowledge that we need to approach with a very sacred attitude, because otherwise, you know, if you get unhitched from it, then it's just destruction everywhere, because humans have a tremendous capacity to be destructive. We've got opposable thumbs and large brains, and we are way too smart to be this stupid. I mean, that's the problem. So we need our cultures to provide us with that knowledge and to provide us with, you know, an attitude of awe toward, you know, the other members of this community called planet Earth. And so that's adult knowledge to me, is that we are dependent and that we need to be humble and that we need to be participants and not destroyers. And that was not knowledge that I had. I had the right attitude. I wanted to come to life as somebody who was humble. I didn't want to see, you know, the sort of Old Testament view of, you know, go out and subdue and multiply and conquer the earth and all. I mean, I could see how destructive that has been. I mean, anybody with half a heart can see what that worldview has done to our planet. And I didn't want humans to be enthroned above, you know, the rest of creation. But I didn't have all the knowledge that I needed about what that would mean. So, you know, at 16, the vegan option seemed like the best one to institute those values in my own life. I had to learn better. I mean, there was, you know, once I had more information, it got harder and harder. But that is the information that we're missing. And so the destructive nature of agriculture, agriculture is just pure domination because, you know, you're ripping through all those ecosystems. You know, yes. You're just devouring entire continents. So that was the knowledge that I was missing. And it is very much adult knowledge because at the same time as I'm seeing that I don't want these hierarchies and this destruction, I also had to admit that ultimately that life was about death, that those are the same moment, you know, that for something to live, something else had to die. So there's a sadness there as well. I think it's humans. I can't speak for other animals, but I mean, it's humans. We are aware of death. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sort of gives everything that sort of bittersweet quality that even as we can feel joy and pleasure and magic and all the good parts that, you know, life has to offer, there's always that sadness as well that, you know, it will end for us. It will end for everything, that every moment that I'm alive means that I've devoured the flesh of another, whether that's plant flesh or whether that's animal flesh or whether that's bacteria flesh. Somebody else is dying to keep me alive. So we need to see ourselves as responsible to that and know that the most important thing is keeping the community alive, that we need to leave our community stronger than when we came here. And so, you know, what does that mean for those of us who are living in a culture that is so profoundly destructive, that has such a death urge, and that is, you know, hell-bent on, you know, ripping up the last tree and pulling up the last fish and, you know, squeezing out the last drop of gold that they can, the private wealth. So that, to me, is that adult knowledge, is just that enmeshment in this web of life and death. So then you sort of, you know, take that out and, you know, move on to the political part of it. And I feel like in many ways the left has been very influenced by a culture that was created by teenagers. So doing the research for the Deep Green Resistance book, I started doing a lot of reading about the 60s and the culture that was created to sort of support the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and then the sort of hippie culture and what was the overlap and where was it and where wasn't it. And it suddenly occurred to me that this was a culture that was created by teenagers. And the roots of this actually go back 100 years to Germany, but a lot of the sort of cultural forms that were taken up in the 60s actually had sort of lain dormant in the United States since around 1900, 1910, 1920. There were a lot of German immigrants who brought with them a culture that had started there. It was also a youth culture. It was called the Wandervogel. And these were a bunch of middle-class teenagers from the big cities who decided that they wanted to hike around in the mountains in Germany. And so they would go on these weekends and they would go on their summer breaks and, you know, various times when they could get away. And they would, they took up folk music. They did this thing with peasant clothes where they wanted to sort of embrace this very idealized notion of what it meant to be a peasant. So the music, the clothing, sort of wandering around fecklessly, singing songs, and they were willing to nude sunbathing, and they experimented with all the, you know, vegetarian stuff, and very straight edge. They didn't drink, and they didn't smoke, and so a lot of this got transplanted into the United States. When a lot of them were war resistors in World War I, fled the country, immigrated to the United States, and the whole thing sort of lay dormant in California. Until, this is so interesting to me, in 1900, there were more 17-year-olds in Germany than there ever would be again. Wow. So you've got this, you know, the sort of baby boom, basically, of these young kids. The same thing happens in the 60s in the United States, where all of a sudden you've got all these teenage kids. They reach critical mass, and bingo, the exact same culture. And you can trace a line from the Beatles all the way back to the Wandervogel people in Germany. So all these key figures in the beatnik movement and the hippie movement are very directly influenced by these people from 1900 Germany. And so it's the same sort of ideas about dropping out from the mainstream, idealizing peasant lifestyle, though in the United States that either is the, you know, Native Americans or the African Americans, but it's the same very racist ideas of, you know, these people who are, quote, close to nature and, you know, more animalistic and, just, you know, horrible things that, you know, these ideas that are just, you know, sort of make you cringe now when you read it. But anyway, so all of this gets taken up again in the 60s, and it's just a direct line. So the thing about being a teenager is that your brain is doing really different things. The prefrontal cortex, which is sort of the driver's seat of the brain, goes offline for a few years when you're a teenager. This is why teenagers are known for things like flashes of anger that nobody else can quite understand and slamming doors, and they have very little ability to see long-term consequences. So everything's very immediate and very self-centered. You know, that's not a bad thing if you are 15 or 16 or 17, but you need to get over it. And by the time you're 20 or 21, your brain is supposed to be finished. So all those synapses are supposed to be now hooked up again to your prefrontal cortex. So now you can have long-term thinking. Now you can make moral decisions, and you understand the consequences of those decisions. and you have impulse control. Well, the problem was that all of these cultural habits got set up on the left that were, you know, put in place by teenagers. And those got reified and accepted as cultural norms. And a lot of what we're dealing with on the left is still those habits. And we need to really confront this, and a lot of this we're going to have to abandon. There is a really great thing about being young, and this is the gift of youth, is that you can draw really great, that moral vigor. You know, you can draw really great black and white lines. There's a foolhardy courage that every single movement needs. And especially during research for the book, it was the same pattern over and over, where you'd have a generation or two of kind of the adults trying really hard to get to win some kind of concessions from the system, whether it's the civil rights movement or, you know, whether it was the Irish struggle, whether it was the women's suffrage movement. You have these two or three generations that try and try and try. And then all of a sudden there's a flush of new energy of especially young people in their teen years. And they have that kind of courage and they've got that moral vigor. And there's this great quote from Christabel Pankhurst. She said to her mother, she was only like 10 years old, and she said, "How long you women have been trying to get the vote? For my part, I mean to win it." And her mother thinks, wow, is there a difference between trying to get the vote and actually winning the vote? Right. And she realizes at this moment, it's like, and she says, I mean, it's in her journal, she's like, I realized what we needed was to find a way to hook up the young people with those of us who have been doing this for a generation or two. And if we could do that, if we could have, you know, the experience of age and, you know, the courage of youth and the vision of youth, we could create a movement that could do this. And that's exactly what she did. And, you know, women won the vote. But, you know, you read the whole history of it, and that's what she did. And it's the same with the civil rights movement, where you've got a generation or two of, you know, sort of from the freed enslaved people on through the Pullman Porters and the Harlem Renaissance and all this. And then finally, you've got that generation, which is like, we've had enough, we're going to do this. And they do. And they're incredibly brave, and some of them die. But, you know, they confront power in the streets, fire hoses turned on them. You're talking about 12-year-olds, you know, facing down German shepherds. Mm-hmm. Just incredible courage. But that's what you get when you're young. You know, you have that kind of courage. So we need that, but it needs to be tempered by the long-range thinking that adults can bring to this project and the experiences that those of us who are middle-aged and older have. You know, we've learned things about what works and what doesn't. And I think that we have, so we can bring that, but I think that the task of middle age, of course, is to hang on to some of that idealism, you know, against the kind of rough wear of despair and failure. So, and that's why every movement needs that infusion of youthful energy. But, you know, you've got to have that kind of cross-generational, you know, sort of fertilization back and forth. And that there, our movements really need to be intergenerational again. And that's the thing that corporate America has done, is, you know, they created this. Every 5 years there's a break in the generations, and yeah. That's what they do on purpose, you know, so that we can't keep our cultures going. All we have now, especially if you're a white person, is corporate culture, which is absolutely deadly. I mean, it's just the ugliest, stupidest, you know, violent, nastiest culture that's ever been created, utterly about selfishness, you know. And there's no way to resist it if we can't keep the flow between generations going to pass on a real human culture. And they've been really good at this. I mean, they figured out exactly how to do it. I mean, they know, like, down to, like, just insane levels of this. They know that if they can get kids, they call them nagging events. If they can get a child to nag their parents 7 times, the average parent will give in. And this is especially true of fast food. So their job, when you leave the house, corporate America's job, is to get your children to see 7 billboards to McDonald's or hear 7 ads on the radio for McDonald's. Because if they will nag you 7 times, you'll give in. You've had enough. So they're basically creating a culture where parents and children are at each other's throats all the time. And, you know, they're real good at it. So this is another thing that we're up against. But we need those cross-generational, those relationships to be sturdy and strong and to really inform this culture of resistance and the resistance movement that we need to build.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, I was at a talk that Derek spoke at via webcam that he did back in, I think, November 20th. And there were a lot of older people in the crowd, I would say, in the 60s and in their 60s and 70s year. And they seemed to me had far more appreciation and understanding what Derek was saying than a lot of the younger folks that were there. You know, it was interesting, sort of that, because there was a real spread, and there's sort of the group that was in their 30s and 40s, and then there's a group that's, you know, that have been there, and they understood, you know, a lot of what he was talking about. And I was thinking, you know, sometimes I'm frustrated by the fact that so much of what's being pushed out there, especially you mentioned it within that corporate culture, is that within the corporate cultures too, as you can see this in the movies and everything, everything is young, everything is, and anything that's old or anything that is too young is not valued, but there's a certain age group that's perfect, and this is where you're supposed to be, and this is where you're supposed to think, and this is what you're supposed to act like. And it seems to be really, we disenfranchise so many people as a result of that. Right. But the other thing, when you talk about the culprit culture that you talked about, the other part that reminds me and it makes me think about the other part of the thing that you bring up in the book, and that is patriarchy.
Right.
And maybe I'm making this leap, but there seems to be that there's a connection between agriculture, patriarchy, and really, but how has those sort of that patriarchy has that, you know, affected one, our relationship with our food, and then with ourselves and then our society?
Well, Rhian Eisler talks about the dominator mode of cultures, and it's like once you have this template where hierarchy is acceptable, it sort of spreads everywhere across the culture. So if you say that, you know, men are above women, and white people are above people of color, and rich people are above poor people, and, you know, able-bodied people are above disabled people, once you've got that hierarchy, then your whole culture becomes infected by these relationships that are about domination and subordination. That, of course, that's not a model that's ever going to get us to an egalitarian culture. And I would say that, it, you know, the core of all of this is really a very toxic concept of masculinity. And so when you've got young boys being socialized and their basic identity is to see themselves as, you know, their whole personalities are organized around not being girls. Sociologists call this a negative reference group. And I would say that that's really at the center of what masculinity is. And the worst thing you can call a man is some form of woman. And, you know, we can sort of go down the, you know, degrading hate speech that, you know, degenerates to. But ultimately, you know, when you're raising some human beings to see themselves as not a despised other, I mean, this is not a project that's going to have any kind of a good future. So there's this, you know, constant urge to prove, no, I'm not that, you know, disgusting other. I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm this. And, you know, this works very well for militarized cultures because, you know, you need a psychology that is able to turn other human beings into dehumanized objects so that they can be killed, so that they can be subdued. And, you know, the primary one in patriarchy is, you know, men seeing themselves as not women and as, you know, women being these despised others. But, you know, you can take that psychology in an 18-year-old and say, well, just substitute Vietnamese people, substitute black people, substitute whoever it is you need to conquer today. It's really easy just to sort of switch gears and, okay, fine, we'll make those people be the dehumanized objects that we can do with what we will. So the other thing about this is the other core of this is that it's a personality that always has to prove itself. And there's a violation imperative that men only feel like they're men when they're breaking a boundary. And, you know, the first boundary being turning a human being into an object. I mean, that is breaking a boundary and goes from there. So now physically you can do anything you want to them. So, you know, you're teaching young men how to do this. And so that violation imperative, you know, carries across the culture. So, you know, agriculture is violating the ecosystem in the same way. Living communities have boundaries. You know, they have integrity. And when you do agriculture, you utterly destroy that. Rivers have integrity. When you dam and drain a river to do irrigation, you are violating its integrity. You know, that is a living community. That is a living being, we could say. That river has a spirit. Mm-hmm. And when you violate that river, you are violating, you know, a creature that has a being that has a right to exist on her own terms. So all of agriculture, all of this destruction is based on that endless drive to conquer and to subdue and to find some kind of pleasure in that subduing. And that is, to me, is really the deep heart of patriarchy, is sadism, is that urge to control and to dominate. And the brilliance of patriarchy is that it takes acts of oppression. In any other circumstance, we would see these as political acts of oppression, but it turns them into something that is experienced sexually by the perpetrators. So, you know, you get this rush of power in men who are doing these things. And it's you could not find a more potent reward system than, I would say, sexual pleasure or sexual reward. And it, of course, it feels natural. So how are you going to, you know, it's like fighting God. How can you fight nature?
Right.
So it makes it even harder for people to recognize this is what's going on. And it's just as true with racism, I think. And this is why, to me, it's like if you're going to be anti-racist, you have to be a feminist. And if you're going to be an environmentalist, you have to be a feminist. Because really at the core of it, that this to me is, you know, the deep, dark heart that we have got to face and eradicate from this culture. And it extends across everywhere. So, you know, you can conquer the ecosystem, while you can also conquer the genetic code, so that you've got, you know, each species has its own boundary. And now these scientists are doing you know, genetically modified organisms. That is a terrible violation of the boundaries of a species. Or, you know, a few months ago, they, quote, punched the face of the moon. You know, they blew up part of the moon. Well, you know, you couldn't get a more, there it is. You know, they're violating space, beating up the moon. Like, great, take it into space, guys, you know. So everywhere you look around this culture, you're going to see this kind of the same thing where it's, you know, domination and it's violation and it's utterly normalized. It feels like it's normal. But again, these are always acts of political oppression, and it's not normal. It's not, you know, it may be normalized, but it certainly isn't the way things have to be. I mean, it's not decided by nature. It wasn't decided by God. These are political institutions that humans arrange, which is to say that humans can bring them down. So I would say that that is, you know, something else that I had a lot of problems with when I was vegetarian, because I wanted agriculture to be this nice, peaceful way of life that, oh, I don't know, somehow was going to cure all the ills of the planet. And, you know, the more I learned about it, the more I could see that it was just as destructive and violating. And, you know, the whole myth of Genesis is subdue the earth, and that's what agriculture is. So, again, I had this sort of tremendous amount of information that I had to keep avoiding in order to stay a vegan, because it did not fit with the framework that I was trying to live by in my life.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, I want to ask this question because my mother said the same thing. Everyone has to be, just the same line you said, everyone has to be a feminist. From your point of view, what does that actually mean?
It means that we have to reject every form of domination and hierarchy that exists. And we need to root that out of our culture. We need to root that out of our personal lives. And especially we need to rearrange the institutions that govern our lives and that control the material conditions along lines of justice and not along lines of power. And so that, to me, that's what it means. So it's across the board. It's, you know, the power that humans have over the rest of the planet, all the other beings that are here with us, the power that men have over women, the power of the rich over the poor. All of that is going to have to be confronted and dismantled if we're going to have a peaceful egalitarian world that has any hope for a future. And we are down to the wire, so we kind of got to get on that one pretty fast. But, you know, in the end, it would make for a much better world. I mean, I don't really get why people want to defend this way of life. It's so brutal and so vicious and so ugly. And there's a quote from Adrienne Rich, the poet, where she says, "Without tenderness, we are in hell." And we are in hell, people. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than what we're living with now. So we can get out of hell, but we are going to have to do the organizing and the sacrifice that's required to do that kind of activism.
Resistance and responsibility, because you've talked about it a little bit. How are those two combined?
Well, I would say that for me, and this is throughout the course of my whole life, I have always felt a tremendous responsibility to fight for justice. That was why I came here. That's what I intend to do, and I am not giving up. I don't know why other people don't feel it. I don't really understand why everybody isn't out on the streets demanding a more just world and a more sustainable world. They're not, and I don't really get it. And I've never been able to understand it. I am not somebody who's been able to sit by and watch injustice happen and not do something, whatever's in my power to do. So, you know, we can make these sort of arguments of moral exhortation, and maybe that inspires some people. And maybe it's just that there's only a small percentage of us that are ever going to feel that as deeply as we need to stay in the fight long term. I mean, I think about a lot of the people that I did activism with in my 20s, especially the underground stuff, and I'm pretty much the only one left standing. I don't really know what happened to the rest of them. I don't know why they're not still fighting. Some of them I thought were in it for the long haul, for sure, and they just weren't. I don't know what that means in terms of maybe we can never count on people to really be there long term. And maybe we just have to accept that there's only a few of us that are going to do that. It's true that you don't need that many people to actually get something going. But, you know, part of my job right now is to take the people who feel that responsibility and have that passion and help them direct it a little bit more. Because right now we're being directed toward personal consumer choices as our main strategy, and it's frankly absurd. So I'm trying to provide more of a framework that explains what resistance is and how we might go about organizing that. And my hope is that the people who feel that kind of responsibility will take it up alongside me I obviously can't do this alone. I mean, me and Eric and Derek and, you know, a handful of others are pretty much the only people who are talking about a serious resistance movement. And I don't really know why other people don't feel the same responsibility for that. Our planet is being drawn and quartered. There may not be life in 100 years. It really might be that bad. And if all the methane gets released and, you know, global warming continues, there might not even be bacteria. I mean, it's just, there might not be anything left but rock. So at that point, we have definitely let down our responsibilities. And I don't, like I said, I don't know why other people don't feel this. I can't think what could be more compelling than all of life. So we have that responsibility, and maybe it's that moral exhortation doesn't work. But I like to think that more people out there than not would feel something if somebody could, A, explain just the depth of, you know, what we're up against, but B, give them a way out. Because I think that a lot of people turn toward these personal lifestyle solutions because it's easy and it's what's being presented. It's what we're told to do. And so they cling to this idea that, you know, if I just buy this, if I just change my light bulbs. And part of it's just despair because it is overwhelming. If you've been, you know, if you've opened your mind and your heart even a little bit to the horror of what's happening to our planet, you want to do something, right? Mm-hmm. If you feel that responsibility, you want something to do. So when every major, you know, environmental leader is saying, well, change your light bulbs, well, all right, we'll all go do that now. And not many people are pointing out that this is basically a useless solution. So, you know, I guess my responsibility is to try to tell the truth as much as I can, to be as brave as I can in terms of talking about militant resistance. And, you know, if it lands me in jail, it lands me in jail. But I'm taking my responsibility seriously, at least on that level. And I hope that there are other people following behind me who can take up their role in forming that militant resistance that we need.
You're a co-presenter of Deep Green Resistance, and you've talked about the book that you're working on with Eric. But I wonder if you can just talk more about Deep Green Resistance as the workshop that the three of you put on.
Sure. Well, we had our first Deep Green Resistance, I guess, 3 years ago now. And what we discovered was that people came to the workshop. I mean, we build it as, you know, if you're a radical environmentalist and you know these bad things are happening and you want to do something, let's all get together and talk for a weekend. And we had it in Massachusetts, in New England, and about 30 people came. And it was really interesting because on the first night we went around and the opening question was, you know, for small group discussion, what do you think is the most important thing that we could do right now to save the planet? What do you think is number one activity? And they all said two things. They said permaculture and education. And I was profoundly depressed that that was the best we could come up with. So we had like a little confab behind the scenes with me and Eric and another friend of ours who was there. I was like, we've got to be able to come up with more than this. I mean, if these are the most radical people around and this is the best we can come up with, we're sunk. So the next morning, we totally changed the schedule around, and we basically decided to try to get them to think as if they were a political resistance movement. So we wrote down a whole bunch of different scenarios that they had to think about in small groups, pretending that they were living in a place called Feralia, and that in Feralia, this horrible, nasty, giant corporation had taken over everything and was destroying all the forests and destroying all the rivers and wiping out 120 species a day, destroying the indigenous culture, and all that was left was the corporate culture and terrible food and, you know, deserts looming all around, plus a dash of fascism. Mm. So, given that this is a situation, doesn't sound like anything I've ever experienced, what are you going to do when this happens? And so we gave them a bunch of scenarios to talk about, like, you decide to form a resistance movement. How are you going to get people on your side? Or they are now going to start selling water. What do you and your group do? Or they are setting up prison camps for anybody who's going to resist. You know, what do you and your group do? And we made them actually think about it. And the amazing thing was that I would say 98% of the people in that room could actually think like a resistance movement when somebody asked. And up to that point in their lives, nobody had asked. And this is where the environmental movement is completely falling down. I will never understand why. It could not be worse than 120 species every day. But nobody's telling the truth. When they were faced with the truth and asked to think, they could do it. And that was really the beginning of Deep Green Resistance. Right. We thought, well, if there's all these people out there who know how bad it is and they really have faced the depths of the destruction and, you know, the very slim margin of time that we have left, what if we get them to think like a resistance movement? What would it take? You know, if we had 2 days, what's the information they would need? What are the kinds of discussions they would want to have? What could they walk away with? And so that was sort of the theme that we organized Deep Green Resistance around. And I think we've done maybe 6 of them at this point. Each time it gets better because, you know, we learn things each time we do it. But I got to say, it's a lot of fun because people really can do it. We let people self-select a lot as well. Like, if you're somebody who really wants to talk about changing the culture, there's a role for you. If you're somebody who wants to talk about, you know, doing above ground organizing, there's a role for you. If you're somebody who wants to talk about militant resistance and attacks on infrastructure, there's a spot for you as well. So there's all levels going on during Deep Green Resistance workshops because there really is a role for everybody. And we all recognize that we've all got limits. We all know, you know, what in our hearts, we know what we're called to do. We know what our strengths are. We know where, you know, where we're going to draw the line in terms of what we're all capable of. So there has to be room for everybody. But, you know, luckily there is. I mean, there's so much that's wrong. There's definitely a role for everybody to play in a culture of resistance and in a movement. So anyway, we put them through their paces for 2 days. And we have extraordinary results. People have a great time, and we get great email afterwards, too, where everybody says things about how it's really changed their lives, and they are able to think in a completely different way about what resistance means and what it doesn't mean. So, and that also was the beginning of the book, because we thought, well, you know, we can only get to so many people doing these workshops, but if we had a book, this is really what we need is a manifesto. We need somebody to just write this down and explain step by step what resistance movements do and how this applies to our situation and what is our best bet to stop the destruction of our planet. Not actually that hard, intellectually speaking. I think it is hard emotionally for people to come to grips with this, but it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, we just would do the things that other resistance movements have always done. We don't have to come up with anything new particularly. We just need to apply it to our situation.
At the DGR, you also talk about the difference between liberalism and radicalism, and you spend a good deal of time with it. If you can give us a sort of a brief outline of what the difference between the two.
So these are two different political philosophies, and I think a lot of times in small groups and even in larger movements, these differences are not laid out, they're not well understood, which can lead to a lot of conflicts, both personally and in terms of strategy. So in the end, I don't really care if somebody would rather be a liberal than a radical, but I think it's really helpful to understand what the differences are so that we can make more conscious decisions about what kind of strategies we do want to propose as we're doing activism. There's two really big differences. And the first is that liberals see society or culture as made up of individuals. So the individual is the basic unit of society. Now, for the radicals, the basic unit is actually classes. It's groups of people. And this is the debt that all radicals owe Karl Marx. You don't need to be any kind of a Marxist to agree with this. But he's the one who really nailed that one down. And in his case, it was economic class. But, you know, you can extend that everywhere. So if you're a radical, you understand that there are groups of people that have power over other groups of people. And I came to that first as a feminist, but, you know, once I got that men had power over women, I could see that white people had power over black people and, you know, on down the line. And that's not individual. It's not, you know, this one person has a bad attitude toward me. It was like, well, actually, no, there's a whole bunch of people who are going to do these things to me. And they've arranged all the institutions of society so that they have a right to do those things, so that no matter what harm befalls me, I may not have any kind of recourse. I don't have it socially. I don't have it legally. You know, I don't have it in terms of religion. You know, they own the media. It was like, I could see that they had power, you know, across the whole society. And so that's a radical view. The liberals would say, well, it's basically just that, you know, people have a bad attitude. And that is, you know, the other difference is that liberals see society as made up of attitudes and ideas. So it's a mental event. Whereas radicals understand that these are institutions that control the material conditions of our lives. So this is why, like at the first DGR, you know, they came up with permaculture and they came up with education. And these are very liberal solutions to the problems at hand because they're personal solutions. So it's not seeing this as a group or a class-based harm, which is what the radicals would see. And it's also, you know, the focus on education means that, you know, you think that the problem is how people think. Okay. So there's some kind of paradigm that needs to be changed. And you do that by going out and educating people and explaining to them. It's all just a big misunderstanding. And if we could just get through to people, then one by one, we would change the world. So that's sort of the quintessential liberal approach to social change. Whereas if you're a radical, you understand that you need institutional change on a much larger level. When people were fighting segregation in the South, they didn't just go around and talk to white people one by one and hope that they had a change of heart. They actually took control of some of the institutions with, you know, whatever power they had. They applied legal pressure, they applied economic pressure, and they fought and they fought and they fought until those institutions caved in, and eventually segregation was ended, you know, with an amendment to, well, first with the amendment to the Constitution, but then, you know, ultimately with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and segregation, you know, was over. So that doesn't mean that the struggle is over, but now at least you've got some teeth behind you. So you change the institutions, and eventually the hearts and minds do change. There is now an entire generation of Black people in the United States who have never had to sit at the back of a bus. They've never had to drink from a colors-only water fountain, and one of them is now president. So you change the institutions, yes, the culture falls in line. People have to change as a result. And there's a whole level of entitlement that white people do not have anymore in the United States because they changed, you know, the institutional, you know, arrangement of power. So that's the radical perspective, is that you have to do that level because it's, you know, because society is made up of groups of people, classes of people, you need to change it at an institutional level. Ultimately, yes, hearts and minds change, but that's how you do it. And it's not to say that there is no role for education in a radical movement, but the point of that education is to build that movement. It's to build that resistance that will then take charge of society in some way. I mean, DGR itself is, you know, obviously an educational experience, but, you know, our goal is to create that movement. It's not to just change somebody's heart, you know, one at a time. So those are the main differences between, you know, liberal and radical. And before that's explicated, I think people tend to gravitate to the liberal part because, you know, liberals are mostly the people who control the environmental movement. So they're going to come up with these personal solutions. They're not as scary as, you know, actually talking about resistance. So, you know, you can feel like maybe you're doing the right thing without actually having to do anything brave or scary. So it's a coward's way out for some people. And I think for other people, they've just never had another option presented. And that is the hope that took behind the book, that if we can actually present a manifesto from a radical action, that people will be able to then take it up. We've got a plan. You know, we'll see what comes next, but hopefully that's what's missing for a lot of people who want to be more radical. They just don't know how to be.
And you made me think there as well. It's something that Eric talked about and Derek's talked about too. Eric was talking about it in terms of what happened to the Jewish middle class that lived in Germany during the Nazi period, and
right.
How they really couldn't understand what was happening to them. And
right.
They would do everything they could to follow the law. They would keep saying to the SS, or Eric was saying that, keep saying to the SS, you know, we're following the law, we're doing the right thing, even to the level where they became snitches. And it's something that I also realized when I went to DGR is that we spend too much time, I think, trying to get change the hearts and minds. That's not going to win in the
right.
long run.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's especially hard for privileged people to understand, even just middle-class privilege, little
right.
than anything else. I mean,
right.
you think that the world is, you know, arranged to help you because, you know, in a certain way it is. You do get people who have positions of authority have been on your side up till now. So I think it's a shock when something like cattle cars are in front of you and ID cards, and suddenly maybe they're not on your side, but this must be a big misunderstanding. Well, it's not a big misunderstanding. They were never on your side.
Yeah.
And I think that's a hard moment for people to realize that this is a culture with a death urge, and the institutions that control it, if you play along, yeah, you can get some privileges. You can get a CD player and you can have ice cream 24/7. But this is not a culture that's on your side. I mean, they want you to buy shit so that they can make profits. They're not in this for your best interest, and they are destroying the planet.
And that's the bottom line, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
It's so many times I think that's the problem, and I think you've talked about it, and Derek and Eric's talked about it, and that is the goal. And focus, what is the goal? What are we really trying to achieve? Focus on that, and that seems to be what's missing. I mean, the planet's dying, so...
Right. A lot of people think that the goal is to preserve this way of life, this
yeah.
level of consumption, but somehow power it with, you know, solar panels or something. It's a tremendous contradiction because this way of life cannot continue. Even if it were possible to provide energy with solar panels, you know, up to this scale, it's not, people, and we've got to face that. But even if it were, why would we want this way of life to continue? I mean, it means consuming the planet. We cannot live at this level of consumption. It's over. On every level, continuing this way of life should not be the goal. Ending this way of life has got to be the goal if we're going to save the planet. So almost nobody's willing to say that. You know, Lester Brown has these, you know, plans to save civilization. And every few months he puts out, you know, this sort of updated version. And it's all about saving civilization. It's not about saving the planet. Because this way of life is never going to be sustainable. Until we're willing to face that and realize that our goal is to stop this. To stop this level of consumption. To stop the burning of fossil fuel. And to try to repair what we can of the planet. We're just going to be at loggerheads with each other because... that's, first of all, it's not a goal worth fighting for, but it's not even a goal that's possible. I mean, there are no more trees. You know, there are no more ecosystems to conquer. Right. We're out of water. The soil's gone. It's, you know, it's run. It's, we're in the end game here. So, but nobody's willing to say that out loud, you know, on a, none of the public intellectuals who are talking about global warming or talking about any of these issues are actually telling the truth about it.
Yeah. And that, talking about that, and I'm wondering if the real issue or one of the big issues is that we identify being civilized with being human, which is really quite a racist
right.
thought as
right.
well.
Right.
If we're not civilized, then we're just not human. I think that that's very wrong. And maybe that's, I'm not sure if that's the reason why we can't make that, I shouldn't say we, but a lot of people can't make that shift.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something. Because immediately when you start actually saying, well, you know, we're over-consuming by a factor of like, you know, 2,000 every day, and people will say immediately, oh, we can't go back. I mean, I don't want to live in a mud hut. That's always what it comes down to, mm-hmm. a cave or a mud hut. That's mm-hmm. what they always throw back. And it's like, yeah, you know, actually, more people live in mud houses than any other kind of house on the planet. Like, right. what's wrong with that? You know, it's perfectly biodegradable. Anybody can make one. You know, they just throw the heat overnight. Actually, they're nice places to live. No mortgage. Hello? Not really such a bad idea, frankly. Somebody was really clever who thought of it. So it's, yeah, there's just this idea that, you know, anything but this level of consumption means that we're all going to be starving and freezing and at each other's throats and life will not be worth living. When in fact, you know, hunter-gatherers had tremendous amounts of leisure time, you know, perfect health, you know, some very beautiful cultures and lots of time for things like naps. And singing and spiritual activities and grooming and gossiping and the things that they consider important are like all the fun stuff. So it's not actually true. And then you look at the average person in the United States who's working 60 hours a week, you know, for what? To give more money to billionaire bankers who've gutted the country? It's mortgage payments and credit card payments. Who's really happy here, people? I mean, half the country's literally on Prozac. So, it's not really working out, in fact, even though we're made to fear any other kind of life. But in fact, this way of life has not even made people happy.
Another question I have, and this is because this is always another kind of an issue that comes up all the time, and this is, how does the violence of the dominant culture differ from resistance? Also, I mean, you talked about the fact already that nonviolence only works en masse. Like, you have to have enough people. So how do those things sort of, how are they different? How are they same? I mean, where do they all sort of fall in?
I think partly it depends on how people are going to define the word violence, because for some people, violence is always a bad thing, and it means any kind of force, and you know, we don't want to do that bad thing because the powers that be use that all the time, and it's really hard and awful and traumatizing, and we don't want a culture based on that, and therefore we need to reject all forms of violence. And I think that there's some legitimacy in that. And there's an emotional draw there for me that I understand. You know, I'm glad that people don't want to be violent. We live in a really violent culture, and if people would even just personally stop being violent, it would be a better place. You know, the problem is that the people who do have the power are essentially psychopathic. They're sociopathic, and they will do anything they want to us. And social change only happens by force. Now, that force can be applied using nonviolent techniques, or it can be applied using all kinds of other techniques, political techniques, economic. I mean, there's all kinds of force you can apply to get systems of power to change, but they do involve force. And this is where I part company with a lot of people who claim to embrace nonviolence, is that they fall into this liberal trap where they think that if, you know, that their moral example will somehow change the people who are in power. And this is a gross misunderstanding of how nonviolence works. The civil rights movement did not work by convincing white people that they were behaving badly. It worked by forcing institutions to change. And eventually, you know, with bit by bit, withdrawing the power, illegitimate power that white people had, and eventually that changes their psychology as well, and they're not as entitled anymore. So that's how social change happens, is by force. Frederick Douglass said it best. He said, power can seize nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And we need to be the people who apply that demand. Now, if you decide that you don't want to pick up weapons, I think that's perfectly legitimate. Picking up weapons is a scary thought, and, you know, it's really traumatizing to hurt people. I get that. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
So then you need to understand how nonviolence works, where you are going to use bodies instead of weapons to apply that force. Force still needs to be applied. So if you're somebody who thinks that nonviolence means never forcing anyone, you will never change the world. If you are somebody who embraces nonviolence and realizes that, force still has to be applied, we can talk. That's a realistic assessment of the nature of power and the people in power. They are going to have to be forced. Now, if you've got enough people, you can do that nonviolently. I mean, I've watched all sorts of nonviolent social movements be very successful in my lifetime. I mean, all of Eastern Europe, well, except for one country, they pretty much all fell nonviolently and, you know, regained their independence from the Soviet Union. And it was an amazing 2 years to watch all that happen. I mean, it speaks to me personally because my father and my grandparents had to flee Latvia when the Soviet Union invaded. So, I mean, I'm a child of, you know, immigrant refugees, and it was just a beautiful moment when, you know, Latvia and Lithuania and the Baltics got their independence back. I mean, it just was very moving for me. But they, you know, all of those movements were based on nonviolent principles, and they did a beautiful job. But, you know, it meant that the entire country was essentially resisting imperial power. Well, if you've got that many people, and they all recognize that they're being oppressed by an imperial power, that they're being occupied, you've got a chance, that kind of movement. As radical environmentalists, I don't think we have those kinds of numbers. I wish we had those kinds of numbers. If we had enough bodies, we could stop fossil fuel tomorrow. Enough people standing on the New Jersey Turnpike could shut down the oil refineries. Enough of them in, you know, New Orleans could shut down the natural gas coming up, you know, into the country. A couple more could shut down, you know, Manhattan and the stock exchange, the Chicago Stock Exchange. I mean, if you had, you know, X thousand people, this could be done. I mean, it could be over by tomorrow at noon. I don't think we've got that many people. I think anybody who claims that we do is not being realistic. So given the numbers that we do have, I'm not, you know, somebody who believes in nonviolence for moral reasons. I believe in being effective at this point because my planet is at stake. So I don't care about moral purity or spiritual purity on that level. I want to do what's effective. And to me, that is what is moral. So given the numbers that we have, I don't think that nonviolence is going to work. What is going to work is potentially, given the numbers that we have and the lateness of the hour, yeah, we need to be thinking about other strategies and other tactics. But, it, you know, does this question of violence, I think, has been severely misunderstood on the left, and I'm not sure I understand why people are unwilling to face the true nature of political power. And maybe it goes back to what we were saying earlier about privilege, that some of these people have simply never faced the pathology of power and how those in power behave toward the people that they are empowered to oppress. I don't think that most black people in the United States are that naive about the nature of power. I mean, you only have to have one encounter with a cop to know that they can do anything they want to you. How many black men are shot every day just for being black, for instance? You know, how many black men have been denied the right to vote because they're felons? All of these ways that power just doesn't care who it rolls over. And then, you know, you only need to experience that a few times to realize that, yeah, it's sociopathic, and we're not going to be able to just talk them out of it. We are going to have to apply force and come up with different institutions that are about justice and not about power to arrange our society. So all of that, yeah, sort of, you know, whirls around when you start talking about violence, because people define it in really different ways. That is how I define it and why I think that nonviolence might have a chance if there were enough people, but we don't have those numbers. So I think we need to get realistic.
So given that, what is the cost of winning? What is the cost of losing? And is it really a choice?
The cost of losing is potentially life on Earth, every last living creature, and not enough bacteria to even restart the process. I couldn't get more serious. The cost of winning, well, if some of us were prepared to die, we could have a serious resistance movement. It's not a game. Resistance is not a game for children. It is always a serious endeavor. People in power will not give up willingly. They will use whatever is at their disposal to stop us. That is what resistance movements always face, which is why it requires courage and why it requires a level of seriousness that the environmental movement to date has not been willing to encourage, to foster. That's not to say, I mean, there are some people who have done very brave things and have been to jail, some of them for a long time. And their courage is commendable, and their fortitude is commendable. I would say the only thing missing is that we don't have a bigger strategy, that, you know, attacking one McDonald's at a time isn't going to do it, and we need to be thinking way bigger in terms of infrastructure. But I think that the courage, that there are enough actual warriors out there that we could make a dent. It's worth a try, because, frankly, what have we got to lose? Well, we've got to lose the whole planet. So yeah. I would say this is the last moment to fight, and there's anybody alive 100 years from now, they are going to wonder what was wrong with us. that we didn't fight like hell when the planet was going down. Whatever you love is under assault right now. So we need to let that love call us to action.
Because this is a question that always goes through my mind, and then are we ever going to get there? I mean, because I very much agree with you, and I want to be there, and I want to, you know, I'm going to struggle to get there, but I probably will never see it for one reason or another. But it's just very frustrating. But at the same time, I think that how important is it that we believe that we are going to win? How dangerous is it to have, you know, that too? I don't know.
You know, I think for some people, in order to fight, they have to believe that they're going to win.
Mm.
For me, I don't need to know that I'm going to win. I just know that I have to fight.
Right.
Because I can't live with myself if I don't.
Right.
So I'm not giving up, even if I think it's absolutely the desperate last moment and we have no chance of winning. I don't care. I'm going to keep fighting.
Right.
And maybe this is because, you know, my mother read The Lord of the Rings out loud to us when I was a kid. But I'll never forget that moment where they're standing at the Black Gate and the bad people bring out Frodo's little, you know, armor suit.
Right.
And they think that it's over, that they have the ring and they have Frodo and Frodo's going to be tortured to death and
right.
It's over. And they're like, so now you're going to bargain. And Gandalf is like, no, you don't bargain with evil. We're going to fight till we're all dead, basically. And that was such a thrill for me at age 8. You know, I thought, that's me. It doesn't matter. You do not make bargains with evil. You fight because you have to. And that's me. I don't know. I don't need to know that I'm going to win.
Right.
have to fight because I have to fight. Having said that, there's every chance that we could win if we would actually apply our minds and our hearts and our bodies to the resistance that needs to happen. There
right.
is still hope. I mean, I already told you how, you know, if we just could repair some of those perennial polycultures in the grasslands, we could absorb all this carbon. It is not too late for this planet, but we
right.
need to understand what we're up against, and we need a strategy that will actually match the scale of the situation. If we can get enough people on board with that, I think that there is enough courage and that there's certainly enough desperation out there that there could be some real warriors who take this up, and maybe some of them need to know that they're going to win. Great, then we're going to win. And for the others, you just need to fight, and so let's fight.
Okay, so we're at the point where I ask you to pick two random numbers between 1 and 10, and these are your Derek Jensen questions.
Okay, I'll take number 5.
Okay. All right, and what's the other number?
Number 9.
Okay. Well, this is actually a really good one. Number 5. Can one steal from a non-human? Why or why not?
Yeah, I think you can steal from a non-human. Stealing is taking more than you are offered. And it's betraying a relationship. And both of those things are very, very possible with non-humans and with the land in general. I mean, every time you dam a river, you're stealing the water and you're stealing the life from the river. And that's, you know, not an invitation we've been given. And it's definitely a betrayal of the relationship, the mutual relationship that we should have with water and soil and trees and land in general. So, yes, it's definitely possible to steal from non-human people.
Number 9 is, what are some of the largest and most harmful lies you tell yourself?
That I tell myself?
Yeah.
Huh.
That's a tricky one, right?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be that the culture tells. I was getting all geared up. That I tell myself. That's hard. I don't know what lies I tell myself. I don't think of myself as somebody who lives with a lot of lies, because I don't do denial particularly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the kind of person who has to read every label, and I've spent most of my life accumulating horror. Because I'd rather know the truth.
Right.
I find even if the truth is really awful and traumatizing,
mm-hmm.
it's way better for me to just know it all and then absorb it and then, you know, do my best to kind of heal up from it. So I don't think of myself as telling lies to myself particularly. Surely there's something. I got guilty pleasures. I don't know if that'll work. That's not really a lie, though. That's just like, I gotta relax now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably, I think I fall into the thing that a lot of women in this culture sort of end up dealing with a lot, which is, you know, hating how I look and hating
mm-hmm.
my body. I don't know if that's like a lie. I feel like that's more of a struggle that's imposed from outside, but I suppose I could be better at fighting it internally. And maybe there's some of it that I've absorbed that if I fought harder, it wouldn't be as painful as it can be. I'm sure every woman listening knows exactly what I'm talking about. So I don't know. Maybe I don't tell lies to myself. Maybe that just wasn't the question for me.
Maybe not.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
I tend to go in the other direction where it's too much truth. And most people are like, stop, we really can't take any more of this.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And thank you for taking time to be on Rage.
Well, I'm so happy that you're doing Rage, and I love the lineup of speakers that you've got already, and it gives me a lot of hope that there's somebody out there doing a show like yours.
We got so many problems, we don't know what to do. Don't even know we got so many problems that we've gotten so used to.
He was only three the first time mommy said no. No, she ain't gonna buy the sled for the snow. Asking where we thought all this magic money might grow. Asking would you rather eat or play in the snow. Frustrated, she told him he would learn when he's old. The night everyone gets tickets to the front row. Not everyone's gotta raise a son of their own. And had some asshole fucking leave him in the cold. As his teenage years started to unfold, he noticed that he wasn't rocking any other cool clothes. And the clothes and the shoes made you cool, that's how it goes. You're gonna get girls with the silver and gold. And though we didn't have them, we still go for it. Other kids time, I'm like, go get a forest. Even asked if he could borrow the four Taurus. But Dolores says she don't go out with the poor kids.
Got so many problems, we don't know what to do. We got so many problems, we've gotten so used to.
Now, Tom stumbled up out of the bar dazed. He knew trouble wasn't far away. He had to tell his wife, but didn't know what to say. When he walked in the door and she asked about his day, would he tell her they can no longer afford the mortgage? Or the white picket fence to fortify the fortress? We could trade in the caddy for a tourist. We'll sort the problems, they'll all run the course. It's a bitch, yeah, I know, but please be supportive. Cause all that matters is us, that's what's important. But what she said is, I'll be gone in the morning. And don't try and call, cause I'll just ignore it. Like, what good's a marriage if we can't afford it? I don't wanna have to live like the poor kids. I don't wanna give up the two Porsches. You better tell them to pour you one more shit.
Got so many problems, we don't know what to do. We got so many problems, we've gotten so used to.
Now, picture a mother, son in Sudan, and he's got two guns strapped into his two hands. Cause his family ran out of the food stamps, while we take for granted all these toucan Sams. Used to go down to the river for the fish, now there ain't nothing left to put in the dish. Cause the corporation's taking every last drip and threw back all the shit that's polluted and sick. The new world borders right across the border, in another war for black gold. And they lying to the world concerning the facts told. Well, some of us actually know the truth is, they got troops patrolling for petroleum. The bombs got families dying on linoleum. They killed his only sister, yeah, it's only one. She was only one.
Got so many problems, we don't know what to do. We got so many problems, we've gotten so used to.
That was the Filthy Politicians with Problems. We'll have Derek's full interview up on Saturday with a full show. And then next week, we'll not have shows every day, but we'll break it up a little bit. We'll have as guests the folks from Fertile Ground, McDonald Stainsby of oilsandstruth.org, and many more. Comments are welcome. Of course, they're going to be screened, but we do welcome comments and even constructive criticism. Thank you very much, folks. And remember, the resistance needs you. This was Count Zero taking us out with Unbreakable. Thank you.